have our reading, and we'll continue on in Habakkuk, chapter 1. Slightly different to as advertised, we're finishing at chapter 2, verse 11. But we're starting on chapter 1, starting at verse 12, which was on page 940 in the Bibles. Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made people like the fish in the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Then the Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest. Because he is as greedy as the grave and like death is never satisfied, he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, woe to him who piles up stone goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. For you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high, to capture the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
What can you do? In about 2 weeks, I'll be returning to Turkey. And Turkey is a country, I was talking to one or two people last night, that I have grown to love very deeply. And I think it'll be my 16th visit working for Langham, and it's an absolutely fascinating country if you've ever been there. I mean, anyone who's interested in history, and particularly ancient history, my first degree was in classics, and so, you know, it's just like amazing. But if you're a Christian, you know, most of the Book of Acts happens in Turkey, and just going around these places and preaching and visiting little churches in towns that actually are very resonant with what you read in the Bible is just astonishing. And I love the Turkish church. Turkey has a population, I think I checked yesterday, is now up to 84 million, so it's much bigger than the UK. But the number of believers, Protestant believers, in the whole of Turkey, it's quite hard to get an exact figure, but it's estimated that it is roughly 5,000 people. So that is little more than the average megachurch in the States on one day. Most of them are from a Muslim background. They're first generation. So that brings all kinds of challenges. And I remember the first time going to Turkey just being devastated by the fact that here was the centre of the church. And I preached in Antioch, it's modern Antakya, near the Syrian border. You can't go there now, it's too dangerous. But this was about 14 years ago, I think. And preaching in Antakya, which was the first mission-sending church in history. And basically, the road from the airport, you see the mountains and hills behind, and the small town. Basically, it doesn't look that different from what it must have done 2,000 years ago, apart from the minarets. And of course, that is new. And I remember talking to a British Christian worker who's been in Turkey for 20 years, and she was explaining to me, actually, you know, we sort of see the story as one of devastation, the church being wiped out and disappearing. Well, it's not quite as sort of straightforward as that. Basically, the ethnic Turks came from the Asian steppes with Islam and came and basically invaded Anatolia and what eventually became the Ottoman Empire. Basically, had always been Muslim. They'd never known Christianity. And they were unusual in how tolerant they were of other religions. And so there were thriving synagogues and churches. They were second-class citizens in the Ottoman period, but they had relative freedom. And actually, the Ottomans did a lot better than many European contexts with Jews and Muslims. So, you know, actually, it was better than it could have been. And the difference, though, was that if you were a Turk and got converted, you were executed. So there's never been a Turkish church in history, literally. There has never been one until the 1970s. And I was preaching a little church in Istanbul a few years ago, and I met a guy who was one of the first 10. He was telling me that he remembers when there were only 10 that he knew of in the world, basically who were Turkish ethnically, Muslim backgrounds who'd come to Christ. So that changes the perspective radically, doesn't it? From zero to 5,000 in 50 years is astonishing growth. Amazing. And there are some courageous people who are doing amazing things, and it's difficult, it's illegal to build a church, although some still have built church buildings. And there is a great deal of hostility and, you know, lack of understanding, of course. And it's actually only 15 years now since two Turkish believers and a German believer were murdered in the town of Malatya. They ran a Christian printing press, a publishing house in Malatya, which is right in the sort of very sort of eastern centre of Turkey, right in the middle. And it was the most appalling and premeditated assassination, basically. Because one of them was German, it caused an international fuss. And thankfully, those atrocities are rare, but everybody in the Turkish church knew them. And still, people talk about them and their witness. The pressures are real. And it made me really understand. So basically, for a lot of people, getting baptized is a real turning point, especially if you're from another religious community. That is actually, you know, a really significant step. It takes real courage. But one of them was explaining to me that actually that's not the scary thing in Turkey, because you can still do that in the privacy of a church community. The scary thing is getting your ID changed, because on Turkish ID cards that everybody by law has to have, there's a little clause for your religion. And to change that, which is legally possible, you have to go to the council and you get it changed. But basically, as soon as it says Christian on there, a whole host of jobs are not open to you. That, in a way, is their baptism. And yet people are coming to Christ. It's amazing. You see people driving around with fish badges on their cars. Here it's just a bit naff. There, it's courageous. I don't have one because I don't drive well. It hits me hard every time I read 1 Peter. Peter is writing to the whole region around Istanbul. Exactly. Around some Bithynia and those areas. And basically it's astonishing that 2,000 years ago they were experiencing similar things. Hostility, aliens and strangers in the world pressing in on every side, feeling scattered and remote. Has nothing changed? And then we go back several centuries before Peter to Habakkuk's time. Has nothing changed? Yesterday we saw how God's people were getting away with terrible injustice. So it was bad in the land, and Habakkuk's desperate for God to judge it because he couldn't see any other way for it to end. God has promised to judge, but he's going to use Babylon, which is nuts. It seems that as we come to the second section, a few years have passed, and the Babylonians, having been complete non-entities, now they're beginning to flex their muscles, they're on the horizon, and this prophecy is now beginning to be plausible. It's like, okay. So the first few headlines in the news are mentioning their names. It's like, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago when people started talking about on the news the Chinese economy, whereas before that I'd never heard anything about it. Now it's every day. It's like, on the horizon, it's just beginning to make sense. And now God's people are suffering. They had suffered under the Assyrians, now they're new kids on the block. And yes, God said that this was going to happen, but everybody's suffering now. And that seems so out of proportion. God, couldn't you have done something without just everything falling apart? And Habakkuk just can't get his head around it. And so in this first section, his second complaint to God is basically trying to get his head around the fact that God seems utterly inconsistent. How does this match up? And it comes in two parts. The first part I called it, I just don't get it. So from verse 12, are you not from everlasting? I mean, okay, so you claim to be eternal, all right? Verse 13, so let's get this straight. Your eyes are too holy, too pure to look on evil, yeah? You cannot tolerate wrong. We got that clear. So far, so good. Habakkuk believes in God's sovereignty and eternity. But more importantly, he believes that he's holy. So evil's going to be named and shamed, isn't it? Verse 12, O Lord, you have ordained them to execute punishment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish. Not just any of them. God, Lord and rock, but them. It's as if Habakkuk can hardly bear to mention the name. The Babylonians are to be God's agents of justice, which brings the obvious question in verse 13. If all that we've said so far is true, then, verse 13, why do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? So here's the thing. Judgment is all about righteousness. So how come you're tools for the job, if you like. Your agents are less righteous than the people who are being judged and punished. It's just topsy-turvy. The whole thing's wrong and might seem right. And verse 14, Habakkuk likens the human race to the millions of fish in the sea. And they're helpless when fishermen come with their drag nets And the fishermen, you know, they're not thinking about the fish's feelings, are they? They've got no sympathy. They're just, you know, doing a day's work. It's tough. It's, you know, it's pretty brutal, very tough life. They don't feel sorry for the fish in their nets. They're just happy with their work. And verse 15, he rejoices and is glad. Yeah, I've got a full catch today. That's food on the table for my family. And to add insult to injury, though, these agents of judgment, or these, you know, fishermen doing the catch, verse 16, they never acknowledge the one who gave them a fishing license in the first place. Or to apply the analogy, the Babylonians never acknowledge the God who authorized them as justice agents. Instead, look at verse 16, using the metaphor of the fisherman again. He sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys choicest food. In other words, he is thankful to the things that bring him his wealth, the tools of the trade. And that is rank idolatry, worshipping created things instead of the Creator. Not the God in heaven. So again, no wonder, verse 17, Habakkuk asks again, is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? In other words, the Babylonians, they do all this horrific stuff. They're pleased with themselves. They don't acknowledge God. And they get richer and richer and crueler and crueler. So Habakkuk is saying, Lord, you've let this happen already, okay? Well, we'll just have to deal with that. What's done is done. It's happened so far. But is this going to be indefinite? Is it always going to be like this? I just don't get it. So, chapter 2, verse 1, I'm all ears. It says, I will stand at my watch, I'll station myself on the ramparts, I'll be there, I will look to see what God will say to me and what answer I am to give for this complaint. I am there, I'm waiting, I'm listening, the radio set is tuned to all frequencies, I am waiting, Lord, sock it to me. That's basically what he's saying. I'll wait as long as he takes, I'm patient, I just want to hear from you, God. What are you on? He's a watchman. But watchman, yes, that was a metaphor used of many of the prophets. But this watchman is not watching out for enemies. He's watching out for God to come and give him a decent answer. And just as yesterday's answer was particularly uncomfortable, so we find today's is as well. Because the key to it is this rather difficult little word, retribution. What are we talking about? Well, the first point is that God responds by saying, the righteous need to live by faith. Very famous phrase. But he doesn't just say, listen, in verse 2. He says, take notes and make it big. So, you know, as another translation, the New Revised Standard, puts it, make it plain on tablets so that a runner may read it. So I sort of liken this. Imagine it a bit like one of those huge motorway signs on the M4. You know, motorway design signs are designed very, very carefully for one purpose only, to be legible and understandable at speed. So, you know, he's not saying, okay, print out the whole of Habakkuk 2 on a motorway sign. Can you imagine the traffic and the problems if basically you're driving past and there's 21 verses? What? And basically there'll be a pile-up immediately. No, it's got to be pithy, sharp, to the point, so that everybody gets it, even as they run past. And God says, get this down, make it clear, make it bold. Get to the heart of the matter. In other words, trust me. That's what it says. Trust me. verse 3. The revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end that will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay, as some understand delays, as Peter would go on to say. Trust me. You're driving at high speed, under 70, obviously, on the M4, and you see white on blue. Trust me. In the meantime, what do you do? Well, there are two alternatives. Verse 4, on the one hand, see, he is puffed up, his desires are not upright. So in other words, just see what's actually going on here. That's one way to live in the light of God's revelation. In other words, carry on as if nothing's happened. You drive past, trust me, forget it, I'm not doing that. Carry on independent, proud, living in God's world without God. That's my sort of thumbnail definition of sin. Living in God's world as if it was my world. That's what we all do, instinctively. It's not about doing individual bad things. It's about living in God's world as if it was mine. Arrogant and idolatrous. Worshipping created things instead of the Creator. So that's one way. The other way is the righteous will live by his faith. Trust me. It's a famous phrase. This is especially important for Paul. He quotes it in Romans and Galatians, as does the writer of Hebrews. For Habakkuk, the problem was that it's so hard to keep on living a righteous life, as you attempt it, when both Israelites as well as Israel's enemies persecute you for it. I mean, you're trying to do the right thing all the time, and basically you get it from both ends. So God says, trust me. But there's a twist in the New Testament, because it also anticipates the problem of being righteous in the first place. You see, how do I do that? How do I be righteous? And that, you know, it hasn't got easier. It's particularly difficult when everybody around you has blurred the lines and transgressed and doing all kinds of things, and you don't even know where lines are. I mean, maybe at work you find you're having to make decisions and you just don't have a framework. You don't even, you know, trying to figure out what might be an ethical thing in this context with this decision on your desk waiting for you. Let alone trying to be godly in what you say. It's incredibly difficult. And the answer is the same. Trust me. When you don't know how to be righteous, when you know you can't be righteous, the answer is, trust me. The righteous will live by faith. By trusting in grace that we are transformed. And that's the amazing thing about God. You see, yes, he is holy, and yes, he does want us to be righteous, but you're not kidding God. I mean, here's a little secret just to let you into. He knows you're not righteous. All right? You might be quite good at kidding people around you. Say, oh, she's so holy. Or, you know, he's such a good person. And yeah, relatively, maybe. But God knows. He knows you are not righteous. Which is why I know you're not. Because I know me. But yes, he does want us to be righteous. And he knows we need his intervention. He knows. And that's why he does something about it. He sends the righteous for the unrighteous. As Peter said, to bring you to God. How else? So that's the heart of the Christian message. It's the heart of the Old Testament covenant message. All the time it's been the same. It's trust me. He offers forgiveness on a plate. Think, really? Too good to be true? Too easy? There must be something I can do. I mean, you know, someone is incredibly generous and maybe pays off a student loan or, I don't know, helps you with your mortgage. Well, there must be something I can do. No. There's nothing you can do. It's you want it. Trust me. No, come on. I mean, there must be a catch. Where's the small print? No. Trust me. The righteous will live by faith. And contained within that, I mean, you're not necessarily going to get it just by that verse, but the way, for instance, Paul develops it in the New Testament, the way the whole of the New Testament expounds the gospel, the amazing thing is that the righteous don't only live by faith, they become righteous by faith. A righteousness from God is revealed that is a gift on a plate. Trust me. Do you want it? Seriously, do you want it? It's yours. It has your name on it. Take it. Or leave it. Trust me. And the arrogant, they just say, well, I don't need that. No, I'm fine. It's lovely for you. Oh, I do admire your faith. Nonsense. Nonsense. No, I'm fine. God says, trust me. And the thing is, the puffed up and the arrogant will face righteousness. But before we think about that, we just need to grasp some of the realities of God's justice. Because yes, back in Habakkuk's time, and in terms of what God reveals to Habakkuk, yes, there are big problems here. It is problematic, without question. For God to use the Babylonians is difficult to comprehend. And I think God gets that. Which is why he says, basically, trust me, they're going to face justice too. Don't think they're going to get away with it. That's the nub of what he responds. He sees what sinful people get up to. And so one of the sort of questions down the centuries is, why doesn't, if God sees all these things going on, and I touched on this yesterday, if he sees, the Holocaust just beginning to ramp up, I watched with the family just the other day, it was a sort of one-off BBC film called Conspiracy about the Wannsee conference when Heydrich and his sort of gang planned to the Holocaust, basically. And it's brilliantly done. Kenneth Branagh is Heydrich and a host of great actors in it. And it is truly chilling because basically it's a committee meeting and they're just discussing logistics and trains and what type of gases are most effective. I mean, it is banal in the extreme and utterly horrific. Couldn't God just make Heydrich's plane crash because he flew himself there from Prague? Wouldn't that have stopped it? Why doesn't God intervene to stop a little girl getting brain cancer? We had a dear little girl die in our church just before Christmas, aged 4, I think she was, 4 and a half. It was extraordinary because on the first Advent Sunday, she lit the candle. And then, actually by the end of January, she'd gone. Lord, why? Why did these things happen? Can't you do something? C.S. Lewis, reliable as ever, faced questions like this. And he dealt with this exact question. He said this: I wonder whether people who ask God to interfere openly and directly in our world quite realise what it would be like when he does. God's going to invade, all right, but when that happens, it's the end of the world. When the author walks onto the stage, the play is over. For that time, it'll be something so overwhelming that it'll strike either irresistible love or irresistible horror into every creature. It will be too late then to choose your sides. It will be the time when we discover which side we've really chosen, whether we realised it or not. We want God to intervene, and he says, yeah, I'm going to. Are you ready for that? In the meantime, God is more at work in the background. So there's no doubt the Babylonians have their ambitions. There's no doubt they don't give God, Yahweh, a moment's thought. They're sitting in their war rooms. They've got their maps. They're strategizing. This is what they're going to do. This was their game plan. They don't have a clue that God is using them for anything. But that is how God's sovereignty works. It's in the background, isn't it? You take the crucifixion of Jesus. One of the most extraordinary things about each of the gospel accounts, but I think, I remember I first noticed it in Mark's gospel, how basically all the way through in those last days, it's absolutely obvious, it's never explicit, but it's completely obvious who's in charge. Not a scintilla of doubt. Jesus is in charge of the whole process. Now, I can't understand all the ins and outs. But God is saying, okay, look, your minds are too small for this. Trust me. Trust me, I've got this. And God is not mocked. So he's not saying, say nothing. He still wants people to expose injustice, and you see that in the next section. And God knows what the Babylonians are. You know, he knows how they make their way in the world. They build empires on bloodshed. Well, it's often been like that. In fact, it's always been like that. The British Empire was built on blood. Now, let's not have any sort of illusions about what it was like. If you haven't picked up, William Dalrymple and Anita Anand are doing an amazing podcast, The History of the British in India, to begin with. It's just called Empire. There are only 4 episodes so far. And it's chilling. And the arrogance of the Babylonians, they burst their boundaries, they devour everything in their wake, they're likened to locusts. They fill their bank vaults and their British museums with stolen goods, verse 6. They plunder in verse 8, they shed blood, they destroy lands and cities. And the fascinating thing is that even they then overextend, verse 7. Just as their empire grows, so do their debts. And creditors always wake up in the end. Always. They always want their money back. Which is something modern governments often seem to forget. Well, in verse 6, God says, woe to those who build empires on blood. And then verse 12, God says, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by crime. Even though we are 2,500 years on from Habakkuk, we're still waiting for the author to walk onto the stage. We long for him to. But it does give hope, as Lewis saw. It gives hope to the vulnerable Christians in Turkey. It gives hope to those in Ukraine suffering the invasion. It gives hope to those trafficked and sex slaves in W1, London. We were surrounded by them when we worked at All Souls. It's a very posh area. It looks pristine, but it's rotten behind doors. It gives hope to those who will sink below the poverty line in this country this winter. God is not mocked. God is not blind. God is not deaf. God is not passive. He is real and he is coming. And that is a very good thing. But in the meantime, what does he say? He says, trust me. But he gets a bit more specific in the next bit. You know, those who build their homes on injustice. I mean, there's a cruel irony. These people have brought incredible harm to others. But verse 10, we see they plotted the ruin of many people. But while they're quite happy to bring suffering to other people, they do everything to protect themselves and their own. You know, woe betide anybody who touches their family. So verse 9, they set their nests on high to escape the clutches of ruin. And well, you would. You have your sort of bond baddie lair that is impregnable, you know, and that's what you do. You've amassed your wealth and then you fortify yourself so that you are untouchable. And you think you are untouchable. And God says, woe to you! He sees it. And he holds the world to account. And humanity, at its better moments, has remembered this. So if you go to the Capitol in Washington, in D.C., and do a tour of it, and you go into the famous dome, bizarrely, because actually the foundation of the United States was not as Christian as sometimes it's claimed, but bizarrely, on massive letters on the inside of the dome are these words: one God, one law, one element, and one far-off divine event to which the whole creation moves. Astonishing. You'd think that would put the wind up those making laws. Well, take this. This is a historian, British historian, don't think he was a Christian, and he contributed to the huge Oxford History of England. And he dealt, this is R.C.K. Ensor, and he wrote about the 18th century, and he particularly was a historian of the Clapham Sept and William Wilberforce and co. And this is taken from that Oxford history. This is how Ensor described many of those, by no means all, but many involved in the sort of public life of the time. He said, if one asks how 19th century English merchants carried the reputation of being the most honest in the world, which was a very real factor in the prominence of English trade, the answer is because hell and heaven seemed as certain to them as tomorrow's sunrise, and the Last Judgment as real as the week's balance sheet. Don't you think the square mile in London would operate somewhat differently if everybody thought that? If they knew that actually they didn't have to give an accounting to the FCA or whatever it's called, or you know, sort of insider trading court cases. If they knew they had to give an account to the great accountant, their behaviour and business practice might be slightly different. The final judgment, the day of justice, is a good and necessary thing. So if you seek glory, you will reap shame. Here's the twist. Look at verse 13. Those who seek their own glory do so for nothing. Verse 13. Their efforts are just fuel for the fire. Empire building, pointless. People will pay the price. The punishment will fit the crime. That, you see, is the principle of retribution. That's what that word means. Retributive. Retribution. It's not a popular word. It's strange because actually, when you analyse it, it's a really good thing. What you don't want is justice that is not retributive. Why? Because it's all about the punishment fitting the crime. This is where the whole business of eye for an eye comes from. One of the ways that people get eye for an eye, tooth for tooth wrong is they think that the individual victim is the one responsible for bringing justice. That's not the point at all. There is a judge, an impersonal judge, who is to oversee the case. So the idea is, if you steal my biro, I don't come and chop your hand off. Because that would be a bit of an overreaction, wouldn't you think? That's not eye for an eye, that's eye for, I don't know, a wink. But with God, it's perfect. He gets it right. And when he judges, the punishment fits the crime. Perfectly. And he says, trust me on this. It's not wishful thinking, it's going to happen. And that's good. This is good news. In a crazy world. So the question is, who drinks this cup now? Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbours, pouring it from the wineskin to the edge, so they're drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. I mean, this is, I guess, the ancient equivalent of using date rape drugs. It's pretty gross. But God sees. God sees those who use date rape drugs. And he said, you will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. In other words, its retribution. You had it coming. In other words, taste some of your own medicine. Verse 17, the violence you've done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you. That's fascinating, isn't it? That God is concerned for the natural world. And what you do in your imperial pursuits to gobble up the natural world, yes, you'll pay for that too. For you have shed man's blood, you have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. And God is saying there is no point turning to idols now. You've got to face this. Because what can an idol do for you? You pick up the sarcasm in verse 18. I mean, of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman? I mean, it might be beautiful. I mean, there are some very nice wood carvings around here. I see some, you know, £100, £150, bargain. No idea anything about them, but, you know, go for it. They look nice in my garden, I'm sure in yours. That's great. But are you going to pray to it? Is it going to help you? Can a wooden god help you? Because if ever there was a god who was blind and deaf and passive, it's a chunk of wood, isn't it? Nothing else. They don't move, they don't speak, they don't even breathe. Fat lot of good they are. Don't turn to them now in your hour of need. Nothing else helps, and God will have the last word, always. He says, trust me. Don't mess with this. Trust me on this. Look at verse 14. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of God's glory. Not Babylon's, not Assyria's, not Egypt's, not Britain's, not America's, not China's. God's glory, as the waters cover the sea. In other words, it is as certain as the world's tides. And of course, in the Lord Jesus Christ, we have that glory fully revealed. As Hebrews puts it, Jesus is the radiance of God's glory. You want to see what God looks like? I love the fact that John Chapman, who's an Australian evangelist, died a few years ago. But he had a great line. You know, if someone asked him, have you seen God? He said, no, but I would have done if I lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago. Because God walked there. He got his feet muddy in the Jordan. God, yes, that God, the creator God, who's no idol, a living, breathing, not blind, not deaf, not passive, involved God, who says, trust me. But as I finish, before we wrap it all up this afternoon from chapter 3, there's one verse to leave ringing in our ears. And that's chapter 2, verse 20. This is the reason to trust him. Yahweh, the God who has made a deal, created a covenant, who has spoken something into being, who's taken initiative. Can an idol take an initiative? But Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. That's the least we can do, isn't it? Be silent. If you don't know what to say, stay that way. Be silent and think about whether you can trust him. Because he's demanding. He says it's for free, but it takes everything. So, yeah, be quiet and think about that. Because the day will come when it'll be too late. But it'll be a great day. Probably a confusing day. Certainly an overwhelming day. And it will be good news for the cosmos because it'll be a day of justice. But I guess, using the words of this passage, we need to decide for ourselves whether or not it is a day of joy or terror. Heavenly Father, we come before you conscious of so much that we do not understand, so much that confuses us, so many things that are beyond our ability to comprehend. There's so much about you, Lord, that we don't get. You are so much grander and bigger and mightier than we could ever conceive. And that is actually how it should be. But Lord, we believe, help us in our unbelief. We trust, help us when we struggle to trust. We need your Spirit, Lord. We pray that we would become righteous because we trust you, and that we can thereby live because we trust you. And that is your work, that is your gift, that is your gospel. For that, we are eternally grateful. In Christ's name we pray.